public enemy. This is a hot dog.
Hey everybody, welcome to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm your host, Scott Horton. It's the Republic Broadcasting Network. My website is weekendinterviewshow.com. Also, I'm a contributor to antiwar.com. If you go to weekendinterviewshow.com, there's a link right up there at the top to sign up for the podcast. You get the automatic download of all the new interviews, commercial free. Got a great show lined up for you today. First up, Ann Norton, and then in the second hour, we'll be talking with Juan Cole about the situation in Iraq. But first, we got to talk about the politics of American empire. Over the past few years, people have become aware of the existence of a formerly obscure professor of political philosophy at the University of Chicago named Leo Strauss, as his disciples have formed what is described by some to be a cult of personality and power inside the Department of Defense, the Vice President's Office, the National Security Council, and on the pages of America's leading conservative papers and magazines. More than a few of these disciples of Strauss were and are involved in the planning for and prosecution of the war in Iraq. To help us sort out the relationship between Strauss, his students, and our foreign policy is Ann Norton. She's a professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania and has taught at UT here in Austin, Princeton, Notre Dame, and at the University of Chicago. She's the author of the books Republic of Signs, Liberal Theory and American Popular Culture, 95 Theses on Politics, Culture, and Method, and Leo Strauss and the Politics of American Empire. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Scott.
Thank you so much for being here. I think maybe, hopefully, we could start off with just a bit of Strauss's history. Who was this guy? Where did he come from? Where did he teach? And maybe a sketch of what it was he believed?
Yes, sure. Strauss has a very interesting and rather moving life story. He started out as a young German Jewish student of philosophy in Germany. And, you know, as the 30s came and Jews and indeed many other people resisting the Nazis came under threat, he left Germany. He left Germany in a rather interesting way. He was able to leave Germany in part because a man who, a legal theorist named Carl Schmitt, who later became known as the crown jurist of the Third Reich, got him a fellowship in England, which enabled him to leave the country. So in a curious kind of way, it was a man who was affiliated with the Nazis later who helped get Strauss out of the country. And Strauss and Schmitt had some things in common intellectually, so that has a good deal to do with it. And then Strauss came to the United States. He came first to New York, where he taught at the New School for 10 years, and then moved to the University of Chicago, where he had a particularly strong influence.
Why? People make such a big deal about this guy. I think a lot of people, we go to college, we have professors, and we don't make that big of a deal out of them.
No, you don't. And it's interesting when people talk about him. When, they almost always say the same thing. They say, Leo Strauss taught me to read. And what they mean by that is that the ordinary act of reading was different for him. He taught them to see that there was a lot more in the text that they had read, that they could learn more from something that they felt that they had understood. And this was so illuminating for many people and so exciting that they felt that they had learned to read all over again. Basically,
right.
What he was doing was something very old and that goes on all over the country and indeed all over the world. He was teaching people to read any book, but especially great philosophic texts, in the way that people read the Bible and the Talmud and the Quran.
It's
a very old way to read the text.
That is taking things instead of literally putting more parable behind it, or seeing it more as reading between the lines, so to speak.
Reading, doing all those things. Looking at a text and asking, looking for what's said, looking for what's not said, looking for things that might be said in a different way.
All right, everybody, we'll be right back with Ann Norton. All right, my friends, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm your host, Scott Horton, and I'm talking with Ann Norton. She's a professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania and author of Leo Strauss and the Politics of American Empire. And you were saying that the Straussians often say that Strauss taught me to read. And I guess if Strauss is the only one who can teach someone how to really read, then that means that anybody who wasn't taught how to read by Strauss or one of his students is therefore incapable of understanding what we who really get it understand.
Strauss wouldn't have said so, but some of the Straussians might. I mean, Strauss is a man who appreciated the work of other scholars, and he knew that what he was doing was not new and it wasn't something that just he could do. But it is true that among some of the Straussians that I went to school with, there was this view that that there was an elect group of people who knew the truth, and then there was the rest of the world who didn't. One finds that in all sorts of groups, but it was the thing you came across in some not too bright Straussian students.
It's sort of Plato's philosopher kings, right? We understand how it works, and we get to boss you around.
That's the principle, although I think it's not fair to Plato. Plato was a little bit smarter than that, in my view. But yes, absolutely right. It's that view that that there's an elect, and that the great unwashed or the teeming millions don't really know, and one can manipulate them without any guilt. In fact, it's for their own good that they're manipulated.
Now, people say that Strauss sort of emphasized a Hegelian view, which, you know, I can't say that I'm as well-versed in all these philosophers as you surely are. But I'm kind of confused by the Straussians seem to have, you say in your book, this contempt for the last man. When all the arguments are argued and the last man is left standing on earth, he's someone to be despised by these philosopher kings, apparently.
The last man is this figure who comes out of Nietzsche. And the last man is supposed to be basically somebody like, I don't know, maybe not you, but somebody like me in some way, somebody who likes a comfortable life, who wants to have a reasonable way of life, have enough to eat, have a comfortable place to live, maybe have a nice dog, you know, get a little car, go out there and live an ordinary life. And Nietzsche had a certain contempt for that. And many philosophers in the early 20th century did as well. I personally think there's a lot to be said for ordinary people who want nothing more than to live a decent life. There is a sense among the Straussians, lots of Straussians, that contemporary human beings have lost a sense of moral seriousness. A number of people in the present administration talk that way. Like, for example, one of my teachers, Leon Cass, who's head of the President's Council on Bioethics, that people lost a sense of moral seriousness, and what they need to get it back is war. And that war will enable them to sort of recover their manliness. They think that somehow men in particular are subject to this, and they've lost their manliness, and they need war to get it back. I may say that I come from a military family, and as far as I know, none of the men who talk this way have experienced war at all. But it is something that you come across from time to time, this idea that people are sort of comfort-loving last men without a sense of moral seriousness, and they need a good war to shake some sense into them.
And you write in your book also about how, I don't know, I always picture the caricature of the dad on that 70s show as just that kind of tough guy, red-blooded, steak-eating American guy who's willing to, you know, go overseas and kick butt if we have to and that kind of thing. And how this is sort of the ideal that's held up by these Straussians, and yet you point out in your book that these men have the softest hands of anybody you've ever met, right? They've never changed a tire, never tossed a football, surely have never served in war.
It's, I find it really, I have, from the time I went to school, I met people like this, I found it sort of amusing but also vaguely horrifying. I mean, I grew up, my dad was in the Navy, and we were over in Southeast Asia during the Vietnam War. I knew men who died in war. And I knew what you thought, but a little bit of what they thought when they went, and certainly what we thought when we saw them go. And I've always thought that people who talk about war as being romantic or restoring people's virtue really don't understand what that's like. So yeah, I think it's kind of contemptible, frankly.
Well, now let's get back into your background a little bit and how it is that you're in a position to be able to explain these Straussians to me. You went to the University of Chicago, right?
I went to the University of Chicago, and Straussians are very conscious, and this I think is a good thing. They appreciate the people who taught them, and they know who your teachers were. And my teachers were the students of Strauss, many of the students of Strauss, and I got a wonderful education from many of them. And some of them I could say taught me to read, and I think of them with great respect. I also went to school with a number of people. At that point, they were mostly men. Number of like young guys who were very concerned with their masculinity and were not very good at philosophy, but who had this, who sort of cultivated that sense of themselves as being a kind of an elect who knew secrets that were hidden from the rest of humanity.
Right, these are the guys who went into politics, right?
Yeah, unfortunately.
You talk about in the book the kind of the split between the students and the disciples. There are some people who really like learning stuff from Strauss, and there were others who you basically describe as a bunch of little Smitherses on their knees doing whatever they're told.
Well, the problem is, in a university or anywhere else, there are some people who genuinely want to learn, and they'll learn from anyone who can teach them. And they go looking for knowledge, like most of us do. And then there are people in the university, as in the rest of the world, who are running around looking for a master. They want to be somebody's disciple, and they're going to find one. And unfortunately, some of these people seized on Strauss and on some of his students. And I think they've always been less interested in learning and more interested in their separateness.
So you think if Strauss was still alive today, he would say that he is not a Straussian?
No, of course not. I mean, I don't know. I never met Strauss. He died the year I went to Chicago. But I don't know how he felt about these disciples, although my sense is that most intelligent political philosophers dislike that quite a bit. But I did know some of his students, and they did not encourage this sort of behavior, but it happens all the same. And I know that Strauss has spoken about a number of things in his work that enable you to say that he would disapprove of I think, some of the positions that his students and disciples have taken.
There's something important about the culture in the city of Chicago and at the university there, where unlike Harvard or Yale, where everybody's parents are, extremely successful and they're very well educated and that kind of thing. You describe the University of Chicago as being the kind of place where everybody's dad's a plumber and nobody, if you wear a new pair of blue jeans, I think you say in the book, people would look at you with scorn for being such a yuppie, and that these are basically blue collar kids who work their way up to go to the University of Chicago. And
it was everybody. I went to school with people who came from fortunes and people who came from absolutely nowhere. And you would never know who was who. It was really a place where what mattered was what you were like, whether you wanted to learn, and how good you were at it. And it was it was about quality, but it was also about performance. I mean, you could set yourself apart, and it had to be your work, not your father's work, not your mother's work, who you were and what you did.
Right. And
in
so,
that sense, it was a good American place. Chicago's kind of like that, like Austin.
Yeah, Austin is like that in a way, too. But
yeah.
So something going on in here, though, is people who don't come from power, once they achieve this sort of high level of status, you say they kind of want to slam the door shut behind them. And now that they've made it to the top, it's their turn to lord over everybody else. They want to keep us all out.
You know, it's a funny thing there. If you come from a family, and I come from a family like this, where you can remember people who worked with your hands, who, were on a farm, who were immigrants, who worked in the coal mines, that there seem to be two reactions to that. There are people who remember where they came from and know that other people can come from those positions and do brilliantly well as well. Or you think, now I'm special, and I've somehow set myself apart from these people. and I'm not. I now belong to this higher order of being. And I don't know what makes people decide on one course or the other, but I do know that in some of the Straussians, particularly Alan Bloom and his students, the urge to shut other people out was very strong.
All right, everybody, we're talking with Ann Norton. She's the author of Leo Strauss and the Politics of American Empire. We'll come back, talk a little bit more about Alan Bloom and the rest of the Straussians right after this.
Peeking in my window, no box in nine. Peeking in my window, no box in nine.
All right, my friends, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton, and I'm talking with Ann Norton from the University of Pennsylvania. She's the author of Leo Strauss and the Politics of American Empire. And you brought up right before the break there a guy named Alan Bloom. And am I to understand that he's kind of the fault line upon which the break between the disciples and the students falls?
That's right, especially with regard to the people who now have power in Washington. Bloom is really, in many ways, the critical juncture for that. Bloom was a student of Strauss himself, Bloom encouraged his students to go into politics much more than other students of Strauss did, and Bloom was also Bloom was preoccupied with manliness. Bloom was interested in preserving class distinctions and inequality. Bloom was one of the people who argued that things like war increased moral seriousness. So, yes, Bloom was very important.
And he was the guy, I think, in your book that you say was the most effeminate of gay men, that it was sort of a joke that this was the guy pushing this whole steak and football and red blood attitude when...
Absolutely. I mean, often to hear him talk, you would think he was sort of a good old boy who said we have to open a can of Lefaf. But he was an extremely queenly man, and... He was also very. He became famous in America for preaching morality and very conventional morality, and yet his own habits were hardly orthodox heterosexual.
Oh, that's very interesting.
But basically, nobody wanted to criticize that. People didn't want to call him out for his homosexuality because they didn't think it was any of their business. But he made being in the closet very useful to him.
Right. It seems strange that he wouldn't get called out on something like that when he's the one making the big deal. I mean, if he wasn't the one saying, you know, we need to have a war in order to increase manliness around here, then I don't think it's really any business of anybody else's. But you got to kind of question, I guess, this is a guy who's maybe tried a long time to deny to himself, and maybe this is like a bit of that backlash.
It's awfully hard to know. I think that now people would have outed Bloom a lot more enthusiastically, but remember that was 20 years ago, and I think people were reluctant to increase the stigmatization of homosexuals, and so there was real reluctance on many people's part to point out that he was being rather hypocritical.
Yeah, they let William Bennett off the hook pretty quick after it came out, his millions of dollars of gambling debts.
Well, there is that old saying about people in glass houses shouldn't throw stones.
Yeah.
And it just seems that people ought to pay a little more attention to that.
All right, well, let's see if we can sort of tie together what was going on at the University of Chicago way back when with what's going on in foreign policy right now in the 21st century. Can you name me some names of some prominent Straussians and the role that they've played in, say, post-9/11 foreign policy?
Sure, lots of them. Probably the one that most people recognize is Paul Wolfowitz. He's moved out of the Department of Defense now, but he was a very important architect of American policy in the Middle East, and indeed American military policy generally, and especially with regard to the sort of ever-expanding war on terror and America's military adventures in the Middle East. There are other people in the Defense Department too. Abram Shulsky, who served in various aspects of the intelligence community, the Pentagon's Office of Special Projects, for example. There are people like Leon Kass of the President's Council on Bioethics and Science Policy in the Bush administration. Francis Fukuyama served in the Defense Department. Who else? Lots of people, Bill Kristol, Robert Kagan, Gary Schmidt, and Paul Wolfowitz, were involved in something called the Project for a New American Century that was very important in establishing the kind of policy that Rumsfeld took on for the American military and indeed for American foreign policy generally. And I guess the easiest way to describe that is the way Bill Kristol describes it in one of his books, and that is that America should, in his words, make trouble in the world.
Oh, that's the same guy that said we ought to go and crush Serb skulls, William Kristol?
I didn't know that quote.
Oh, that's a great quote.
Yeah.
He seems like such a nice guy, too. If you look at him, he's got such a baby face, you know.
Such a friendly face. I've actually met him several times, and he can certainly be quite civil, and he is, you know, he's an intelligent man. But
well,
I
in calmer moments,
politics.
In calmer moments, he calls it benevolent global hegemony.
Oh, absolutely.
Right, and it's not so much about setting stuff on fire as being a benevolent protector of world peace.
Exactly.
All right, folks, this is the Weekend Interview Show, and we're going out to this short break, and we'll be right back. All right, my friends, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton, and I'm talking with Ann Norton. And was Richard Perle any Straussian?
Richard Perle's been involved with Straussians for a very long time. I think it'd probably be easier to talk about him as a kind of ally.
I see. And when you mentioned Wolfowitz and how he's no longer in the Department of Defense, I thought it was interesting that I learned this actually in your book, that Zalmay Khalilzad, who is currently the American ambassador to Iraq, is Wolfowitz's protege.
He's
still got his hand in the Iraq pot, after all.
Very much so.
That's very interesting. Okay, now, I'm sorry for skipping around so much, but let's see if we can do some of the in-between time and figure out how it was that the students of Straussians got into the world of politics. I've studied a lot about the neoconservatives, and most of my understanding is not so much about the Straussians, because that's always a lot more opaque and harder to understand. The story of the neoconservatives that I'm far more familiar with is the story of the ex-Trotskyites around Max Shachtman and how they became kind of right-wing warmongers with their alienation from the New Left movement in the 60s, and how then they went and joined the staff of Senator Scoop Jackson from Washington State. And best I understand, it was really Scoop Jackson's office where the Straussians and the ex-Trotskyites kind of came together. Is that right, you think?
That's quite possible. Another place where these people all came together was the Rand Corporation.
Mm-hmm.
There's probably a third person we should talk about in this regard, and that's Albert Wallstetter.
Right.
Albert Wallstetter was also at Chicago, he was a man who was most famous for studying nuclear war and developing the idea that you could fight a nuclear war successfully without sort of annihilating the world.
Great.
And, opening up the possibility of people actually thinking of using nuclear arms. And he brought a lot of Straussians into the Rand Corporation, and from the Rand Corporation into the government.
Oh, I see. And there were sort of the Shachtmanite guys met up with him there.
And yes, and very much Scoop Jackson. Scoop Jackson was important for, he had very strong connections to the Rand Corporation. I mean, he was, as people will probably remember, he was a hawkish Democrat, very big on defense and military spending. And so he was attractive to people who were kind of making the transition from a left orientation to a right orientation. Although the one thing was always common to them, I didn't realize this until recently when a colleague of mine pointed it out, but lots of the neoconservatives have been defenders of big government for a very long time.
Right, and that is, well, and actually I want to get to that a little bit later, the neoconservative persuasion, just how conservative it is. But as far as personalities in the 1970s in foreign policy, I'm interested in really the relationship as it developed between the Straussians and the neoconservatives and the rest of the foreign policy establishment. I guess most people who have studied the neocons know that there was a conflict there where Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger and then later Ford were working on détente and cooling off with the Soviet Union and peaceful coexistence and such. And my understanding is that the neoconservatives then teamed up with Dick Cheney and then Donald Rumsfeld and his deputy Dick Cheney to undermine détente and work with Scoop Jackson in order to push us toward more brinksmanship.
I think that's a very accurate portrayal of a really strong difference in policy that runs right through to the present day. That split between sort of a realist foreign policy that's concerned with national security and so, first of all, keeping the nation safe, and secondly, you know, spending as little money as you have to on the military, on weaponry, and endeavoring to sort of use diplomacy to keep the world safer. That's what a lot of people call realist foreign relations or realist international relations or realpolitik. And that's what Nixon very much stood for. Which we call it the Rumsfeld philosophy, which was also the philosophy of, to some extent, of Ronald Reagan, was one in which peacetime was an opportunity and for American expansion. And the end of the Soviet Union was not going to, what shouldn't be the end of the end of warfare. It should be the time for America to establish something you referred to earlier, global hegemony, and something a lot of the Straussians, including Paul Wolfowitz, who's written articles with this in the title, the Pax Americana, that America should become the new Roman Empire.
Now, there were a lot of Cold Warriors who, when the Soviet Union fell, they said, okay, great, Cold War's over, let's disband NATO and bring our troops home and we can call off this whole global domination thing. And I guess the neocons just went looking around for a new enemy to fight.
That's exactly right, and they're quite frank about it. One place where you can see them being very frank is Crystal and Kagan in Present Danger, but you can also find it online in the Project for a New American Century, where they make this very clear. When the Cold War ended, they thought this is not. Lots of people said, yeah, we won. That's great. You know, the world's a little better off, a little more free, and now we should start working on taking care of matters at home and using diplomacy. The neoconservatives said, oh, no, this is our chance to make America the new Rome.
Right. And, you know, there's even another split in there, too, where George Bush Sr., not to his credit from my point of view, but at least differently, proposed a new order based on strengthening the United Nations, signing more treaties, deepening and widening the international law, and basically doing everything through the consensus of the baby blue flag of the UN, and the neocons don't even like that either.
No, that's absolutely right. I mean, Bush is in many ways, Bush spent a lot of his time in the diplomatic corps, and he is an internationalist, and that does differentiate him quite markedly from the neoconservative.
And another interesting part, which this ties right in, is the neoconservatives' worship of Abraham Lincoln, Theodore Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt, Winston Churchill, basically all the most dictatorial politicians in American history win all of their credit.
Strong leaders. That's what they want. And, you can see that in a book by Carnes Lord called The Modern Prince. Basically, what lots of the Straussians and neoconservatives want is, and they'll tell you this, they want a more authoritarian presidency. In fact, Lord just says this straight out in his book, that the United States needs a more authoritarian presidency. And it's not just modeled on people like Roosevelt and Lincoln. It's also modeled on people like Ataturk in Turkey or Pervez Musharraf in Pakistan or Lee Kuan Yew in Singapore. That, leaders who are very close or actual authoritarians. And I don't frankly think that's a good model for a republic.
Well, and you say in your book that this is a philosophy very much imported from the old world. They can try to pretend that it's some brand of American conservatism, but this really actually has nothing to do with American conservatism at all, traditionally speaking.
No, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, there are lots of different variants of American conservatism. There are libertarians who you can find libertarians on both the left and the right, and in a way they defy categorization.
Thank you.
I think they do. And there are traditional conservatives as well. And the neoconservatives aren't like either one. I mean, clearly, someone who advocates a more authoritarian presidency really doesn't fit in a libertarian model. But they also don't fit the traditional conservative model. They aren't in favor of a small government. They don't want a balanced budget. They want more military spending. They want deficit spending. They want a big government. They'll advocate a government that's quite intrusive and that exercises censorship. All these things are very much at odds with the whole range, I think, of American conservatives.
Well, and as you said before, too, they have no problem whatsoever with a federal welfare state either.
No, many of them don't. They vary on that. And one of the things about the neoconservatives have been a lot less interested in what's going on in the United States and much more interested in what's going on abroad. That's especially true of the Straussians, who seem to be relatively uninterested in what should we call it, America at home.
What do you think of Powell's description in Bob Woodward's book of Douglas Feith's Gestapo office, where he basically says that they set up a separate government? And in a way, some have argued that the neocon cult, particularly in the Pentagon and the vice president's office, that they really kind of hijacked the government. That it was almost a coup after September 11th. What do you think of that?
I think it's true and not true. It's true in the sense that this was a set of people who had a very well, they knew what they wanted. And they had a philosophy for the United States. They had a plan for accomplishing it. They'd had that for years, especially through the Project for a New American Century. And, they like anyone in government with a philosophy, they wanted to see their philosophy triumph. And they were surrounded in many cases by people who were much less organized, who didn't really have a vision for where they wanted the United States to go, and so they won. And in some senses, I don't think there was anything illegitimate about it, though I disapprove of it completely. But it did have the effect of completely changing the direction, or how shall I put it, seizing the moment and making what had been a sort of slow change of direction a very quick turn.
Right. And, I admit, I expected that after 9/11 that they would make Kofi Annan the star of the show, that as soon as they invaded Iraq, they would turn it over to the United Nations and that kind of thing. And I guess it took me a while to figure out that, wow, the traditional foreign policy establishment really has lost control of the situation here, it seems like.
Oh, that's absolutely true. I think that's right. I think they did lose control of the situation. And instead, we got the policy we have today. We have the war on terror with an unidentified enemy and an unidentified goal, and a great deal of money expended on it and a great deal of secrecy. We have clandestine prisons, which is something I never thought I would see in the United States. And we have a war being fought over and over again by people from less wealthy families for the most part, who went into the National Guard, thinking presumably that they would guard the nation, and instead finding themselves finding a war in Iraq for a very uncertain and ever-changing reason. I mean, first it's the weapons of mass destruction, and then it's to dislodge Saddam Hussein, and, you know, who knows exactly what it's for today.
Well, now we're fighting to free the Iraqi people, give them liberty and democracy.
You think that was excuse number 4 or 5 on there somewhere?
Yeah, that was.
And
that
really
was. If you really want to get a good view of that, you might want to take a look at the Coalition Provisional Authority's website. They have the Coalition Provisional Authority says, in deference to the new sovereign government of Iraq, because of course now Iraq is sovereign and has a constitution. The Coalition Authority website will no longer it'll only stand for historical reasons. And then it says, if you want to understand what's going on in the sovereign country of Iraq, you should look at the U.S. Embassy website.
Oh, that's funny. I thought you were going to say that go to the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq website.
Well, you might be able to find out something there, but No, I mean, even the Coalition Provisional Authority argues that in any real sense of the word, this is unfortunately not a sovereign country. It's a country that is occupied by a military power.
Right, and then again, the U.S. Embassy, staffed by Khalilzad, Wolfowitz's deputy, and Straussian.
Khalilzad is an old classmate of mine. I went to class with him, loaned him my books and all that stuff, and I knew him quite well one time. He's in Iraq. He was not actually Straussian at that time, but he became a protege of Wolfowitz's and connected with the Straussians through the RAND Corporation.
And he was, you know, pretty prominent in his role in running Afghanistan when he was over there telling Karzai what to do. But he's been kind of below the radar screen since arriving in Iraq. But if we think back, that was John Negroponte's job, was the ambassador to Iraq. And if we remember, he was basically in charge. So that's really the role that Khalilzad is filling now. This ambassador, he's not just an ambassador.
No, in an older and franker age, we probably would have called him the viceroy.
Right.
I mean, when the Iraqis can't figure out what they want to do with their constitutional draft, he pays them a visit. He is the representative of the dominant power in that region, which at the moment happens to be us, and or at least which we say the militarily strongest power at the moment. And that's a position in many ways far stronger than being an ambassador, and one which, again, smacks a little bit of 19th century colonialism.
Well, more than a little bit, some might.
Yeah, more than a little bit.
Well, and this goes back to, well, I don't know, when you talked about, I almost interrupted you when you talked about the realist foreign policy of someone, say, like Henry Kissinger. I think that I'm sure they call themselves realists. I think it shows we're in a pretty bad spot when Henry Kissinger is a realist compared to the people who are in charge. After all, if the neocons are morality-based foreign policy, then Kissinger is either immorality-based foreign policy or at least amorality-based foreign policy. And Kissinger himself and his ilk have committed massive crimes and killed untold thousands of people, millions of people across the world, really. The idea that their sort of restrained, responsible, reasonable foreign policy has now been hijacked by a group of crazies intent on determining American foreign policy based on morality, and that they are even in practice far more immoral than even the Kissingers of the world. It brings us really back to the question that's at the start of your book about whether we are a republic or an empire, whether any of this is sustainable for any long period of time at all.
I think that's the great question for the United States. And in that sense, I think the Straussians are absolutely right, that in many ways America is the new Rome. And that the problem is, can you be a republic? Can you remain a republic if you're an empire? And the answer to that in Rome was no. And the answer that political philosophy gives to that is no. If you read Thucydides, Athens ceases to be a democracy when it starts trying to be an empire. And I think that is the great question facing our country. it's very sobering to realize how attractive Kissinger looks compared to the neoconservatives.
All right, everybody. I'm Scott Horton. This is the Weekend Interview Show, and we'll be right back to wrap up with Ann Norton, author of Leo Strauss and the Politics of American Empire. My friends, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton, and I'm talking with Ann Norton. She's the author of a new book, which is at the top of the Truth Squad bestseller list, Leo Strauss and the Politics of American Empire. And to wrap up here, Ann, I want to ask you about your chapter, Athens and Jerusalem. That sort of has its own importance, but it also is a metaphor for a couple of other topics as well.
Yes, that's right. I think it's in many ways the most tragic part of the book, because it's one of the most tragic dimensions of the American situation in the world now. On the one hand, it touches on one of the most admirable things about the United States and the American alliance with Israel, and that's the American commitment to defend democracies. And to recognize that democracies aren't always going to look like they look here, and that religious freedom, even if it's not our religion, is really something worth defending. That Jews, Muslims, that democracy is something that everyone can have in their own way. That's, I think, quite admirable. And I think I agree with most Americans that in some ways the American willingness to include Jews as Americans and to defend Israel and a Jewish homeland is really a very, something that's very close to our hearts. But at the same time, I think that it's been used by some people to license a policy that is not democratic and that leads the United States to engage in unjust activities abroad.
Well, and also unjust activities that end up really showing the difference between the interests of the state of Israel and the interests of the United States. I think it's pretty clear that the invasion of Iraq was in the interests of Israel. They have hundreds of operatives in Kurdistan right now buying up people with positions of power. And they got to break the giant Arab state next door in three. This is great for them, and yet all it's done for us is multiply our enemies.
Well, the interesting thing is there have been reports that Israel was not happy about the invasion of Iraq, that they thought that it would destabilize the region in a way that would be quite bad for them. But I do think that there are many in the administration whose desire to reach, in fact, this is not something I think, this is something people have said in the administration, that reshaping the Middle East after the manner that Paul Wolfowitz laid out did have the protection of Israel at its core. Not just Israel, I should say, because many Israelis do not agree with this policy. In fact, they've been some of the most vigorous opponents of the policy, but the Israel of Ariel Sharon, the Likudnik Israel,
right.
Sharon and Benjamin Netanyahu.
And you do identify some motivation here. You talk about Richard Perle and David Frum's book, An End to Evil, how these guys are blatantly anti-Semitic racists.
Yes, I think that's right. I think that Perle and Frum and some other people who I also talk about, and I think quite frankly that Doug Weiss would be among these, have licensed anti-Semitism as long as it has a different target. Anti-Semitism is fine as long as it attacks Arabs rather than Jews. And that one can say virtually anything about Arabs and Muslims. In fact, many of the same slurs that were used against Jews. And that's acceptable. And that seems to me to be un-American, undemocratic, and indecent.
And, of course, it plays into the hands of our enemies. When Osama bin Laden begins and ends every speech by saying America's true goal is a war against Islam.
Yes, that's quite right. And and Richard Pearl and David Frum in that book say, literally, other people may be afraid, will be afraid to say so, but the true enemy is Islam.
All right, everybody, we'll be right back. Thank you, Ann.
You're welcome.